Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance FIL 240 for spring semester 2026.
Today, risk and return. I'll go through the numbers for a little bit, and then from there, I will do a little more on bonds, walk you through using that Excel spreadsheet for bonds, and introduce one last little subject in bonds about clean and dirty price, and then we'll move on to the new material for this week. So here we go, and I remind you, your Excel assignment is due on the 30th of March. If you haven't already done it, you don't want to put it off to the last minute because it does take about 8 hours to get through it. It's just videos and little quizzes and a final, and then you've got your 100% for 5% of the course. But March 30th is the drop-dead deadline for it. So if you're having some problems getting to it, getting into it, come to my office and I will show you how to get to it and get your certification finished up. But first, a look at the numbers today. And we are having, since you left for spring break, the Dow and the S&P 500, all of the markets just took a terrible drop. This is actually the first bull day in quite a while. And it essentially, you could describe this as probably mostly a dead cat bounce. But I'll talk a little about, walk you through a few of what's the factors that are causing the market such stress right now. On the other side of the world, the Tokyo and Hong Kong, Australia was doing good. On the other side of the planet, they are living the dream. They are in a great economic position to take over all the markets that the United States has abandoned, and they are avoiding getting involved in a regional conflict that is going to become much larger over the next couple of weeks and months. And so they are in great shape. Now, even over in Europe, if you look over there at what some of those, the CAC 40, the DAX, the London FTSE, London 100, they're all doing good. They're looking, they're not in the path of the absolute drain on their economies that a regional war would create. And so they're going to feel quite frisky. However, we are having, it's not closed yet, a darn good bull day today. The Dow is up almost up 0.9%, and the S&P up 500, as expected, is up a little more, and then the NASDAQ is up almost 1.3%. Normal progression with greater risk comes a greater return, at least sometimes. So it looks pretty good from this for the time being. However, let's move down here a little ways and we'll look at what's happening. First things first is oil. Brent is over 100. Crude is getting close to 95. They were actually a little higher than that about a week and a half ago. And the reason, obviously, is because of the situation in the Persian Gulf and in the and places like that. The Strait of Hormuz is now off limits to oil traffic, but that's not exactly what's true. Oil can still make it through the Strait of Hormuz without Iran sinking the ships. The way it works is this. If the oil is denominated in Chinese currency, the yuan, then the tankers can go through. If it's denominated in the classic petrodollar, then it will be sunk if it tries to go through. Essentially, the balance of economic currency power is now moved over to China It will not come back to the United States ever again. And that's essentially, China has become the ultimate economic power of the world. India is part of this too. India is working with Russia because the White House allowed the sanctions to be suspended on Russian oil coming out of Russia, which it was not allowed to, and now it can come out, and that will give Russia hard currency by which it can boost its military spending and ultimately within the next 18 months overrun and defeat and destroy Ukraine. Going from there, we can look at some of the other factors that are going to play in here. But for the most part, right now, what you're seeing around the globe is you are seeing something that is generational. I mean, in 4, 5, 6 generations, nothing like this has been seen. The world's balance of economic power simply moving on to other places. And that is not just with oil, with electric energy. The East Coast had always used Canadian electricity, and the price per megawatt hour has just skyrocketed because Canada says, we're no longer going to play favorites with the United States, you're going to pay the global price. And that means that it's going to skyrocket cost of electricity on the East Coast, Northeast, and that will spread into the Midwest within maybe about 6 months, and you will see electric bills multiplied by 2 to 5 times. Not percent, times. But that's down the road a ways. So we are in an interesting and very dynamic situation. As far as stocks go, we are technically in a bear market now. However, as you can see, bear markets do have their way of having bull days. If you look at the sector map down here, across the board, from technology stocks to consumer defensives to real estate, medical, healthcare, they're all green today. This was definitely a broad-based rally off the low. To some extent, this may be that old philosophy, buy on the dip. You know, when the stock prices are very low, that's when you should buy in. And from many analysts, professionals like me and like many of the people I know, that's a fool's game. It's not going to last. This bull market, this low prices, meaning that prices are going to go up, is not, there's no reason to believe that that is some kind of law of finance. It isn't. Just because stock prices are low, that doesn't mean that they're about to go flying upward for any length of time. So that's where we are now. Let me show you one other one. Gold took a beating. Now, why would gold have taken a beating? It is related over here to the 10-year bond yield. Now, it's down today, but you may remember that the yield had gotten as low as 4.05%. And in recent days, it has gone back up. Now, it's at 4.23%. 4.22%, the yield has gone up. That would mean that the price of bonds has gone down. And these are treasuries, the 10-year treasury bill. Here's what happened in a while back. Essentially, the banks on the East Coast faced an insanely large liquidity crisis. They didn't have enough money. And so what they did was they dumped gold and they dumped treasury bonds to get hard cash to put into their vaults to close that liquidity gap that was happening to the tune of $600 billion. And so gold, they dumped it, which caused the price of gold to drop. They dumped their treasury holdings, which caused the price of treasuries to go down and therefore the yields to go up, if you remember that relationship. And then the Fed stepped in to help close the gap by printing money. Now, ultimately, that will lead to inflation in a few months as that excess liquidity overhangs into the economy. But for the time being, the banks were saved from what could have been catastrophic liquidity collapse. And so that's why you see the price of gold has gone down quite a bit from its high in the 5,300 area. And that's why you see bond yields go up from their lows at about 4.05%. These are the signs of extraordinary stress on the U.S. economic system. And it will not end well, I can promise you that. Find work, find your jobs, get your education done and all that. That's your best defense right now. That and stocking up on cans of Spam. I always recommend that anyway. But there you are right now. And it works in a way that people like you are learning. You're becoming knowledgeable in a way that amateurs are not. And when you put amateurs into the halls where they can actually play with and tinker with a highly sophisticated, highly delicate global economic system, financial system, you're asking for trouble. And so here's where we are right now. Now that I have made you feel good about the future, and I apologize for that, let me take you on to the bonds for just a little bit here. Now, here was the spreadsheet. I want you to make sure that you know how to use this. Because it's just like the other ones. You fill in the white cells in the spreadsheet with the numbers from the word problems, and you will get the answers in a matter of less than a minute. Doing this by formulas or calculators or tables, you're asking for 10 to 15 minutes per problem on these. And then if you're like me, you're going to put in a number or a parenthesis wrong and get the wrong answer anyway. So we're going to go to files here, and you'll hit spreadsheets, and the one that you want is bond calculations enhanced. And we'll download it. And it opens up. You have two panels. Bond, you can have a problem where you have to find a bond price. That's the panel on the left. Or you can have a problem where you calculate a bond yield. That's the panel on the right. You will either know the price and you find the yield, or you'll have the yield and you'll find the price. Those are the two classic problems. Those are the ones that I would put on a quiz and then again on the final exam. And it's not that hard. Just follow how the numbers go in and you'll be fine. And I'll use a somewhat simplified notation system. Bonds are quoted not like stocks. They're quoted in a kind of a weird way. And I swear, even I have trouble figuring out, well, how did they get that ticker symbol from the bond, for the bond on this company? So I'll simplify it for us here. Let's say we have JCN, and let's put the coupon at 6.25%, 2038. Now, that would be just sort of a summary way of describing a bond that is put out by a company with the ticker symbol JCN. This bond pays a coupon of 6.25%, which means that every year it pays $62.50, divided into two payments, each one of those being $31.25. Is that right? No, 75 cents. Is that right? No. Yeah, 31.25. You don't need to know that part down there because I've made the spreadsheet so it'll do it for you. Bonds in the United States pay the yearly coupon in two installments, one each 6 months. Now, European bonds, a lot of them pay once a year. Now, Cengage homework you do and the text will start you out with one coupon a year, one payment. It all comes at once. Now later they take you to the two coupons a year. Okay, here's what's going on. What you know and what you calculate. You could know the yield and you calculate the price. Or you can know the price and you calculate the yield. Now the one yield that is most typical is the yield to maturity. However, there is one called the yield to call, because some bonds can be called in early. So if someone says, find the yield to call, you calculate how many years it is until the call. So we have the coupon rate. In this case, it will be 6.25%. Another thing we need to know is the face value. That is always $1,000. Or if you're quoting on the 100, it's 100, because the quote is 1/10 of the price. Excel, for some reason, has you give the quote on the 100 instead of the price when you're calculating a yield to maturity. I don't know why they do that, but they do it. Now, the other thing that we need to know is the term of the bond. That's how long the bond has left in its life. In this case, this bond's term is 12 years. 12 years. Now, I can give you the price of it and you find the yield, or I can give you the yield and you find the price. So let's start out with giving the yield. Let's say that the yield on this bond is 6.10%. What this means is that investors right now want that bond to pay 6.1%. Now you notice that the bond pays more than that. It's paying 6.25%. So we should expect this bond to price at a premium to par. So here we go. Let's go here to the calculate the price. So in this one, the price we have, the yield we have put on it is 6.10%. The coupon is 6.2, oops. The coupon, let's do the coupon first. Coupon is 6.25%. The yield on the bond, the yield to maturity, I should be a little more specific about that, is 6.10%. The term of the bond is 12 years. Now, you can put this as a 1 or a 2. One coupon is all paid in one shot, or it's paid in two. It really doesn't matter too much which one you use here. You'll get a somewhat different answer, but I will make it so that you have a range where either one of those would get you the credit for it. So I'll leave it at 2 because that's more realistic. And as you can see, this bond does sell at a premium to par. If the yield is above the coupon, the bond sells at a premium. Again, If the yield is below the coupon, the bond sells at a premium. Again, if the yield is below the coupon, the bond sells at a premium. One more time. If the yield is below the coupon, the bond sells at a premium. See, it's above 1,000. Watch what would happen if the investors wanted this to pay, let's say, 6.35%. Whoops, try that again. 6.35%. Now the investors want that bond to pay more than it does. So it should sell at a discount to par, and sure enough, it does. So if the yield is above the coupon, the bond sells at a discount to par. Again, if the yield is above the coupon, the bond sells at a discount to par. One more time, if the yield is above the coupon, then the bond sells at a discount to par. I always ask that on a quiz, on an exam. So make sure that you've got that in your notes. So here we go. Now let's find a yield. Now this is the one where Excel doesn't want the price. It wants the on the 100 quote. Now, if I give you the price, you would want to divide it by 10 to put it in that slot right there where it says price on the 100. I will give you the quote so you don't have to worry about it. So when I give you a problem like this, I won't give you the price because you'd have to divide by 10, and that seems to be a step that some students just forget. So I'll give you the quote, just put in the number, the number I give you. So in this one, let's say that in this one, we know the price. The price is, let's say, $1,012.50. Now you notice that I gave a price there, so I'll have to, for the purposes of this demonstration, I'll have to divide that by 10 to put it into Excel. Don't ask me why Excel does this, it's weird. But when it finds, the formula for finding bond yield is surprisingly full of information Excel wants. It wants the settlement date and the maturity date. So I've made it so that all you have to do is put in the term of the bond, and it will take care of the settlement and maturity dates. Settlement is the day you buy the bond, okay? But if you put in the term, what I do is I assume the settlement is now, whatever now is when you open up the sheet. So you don't have to worry about that. All you have to do is put in the term. So let me do one here. And I'm going to do another one for this one. VCN, let's say 5.85%, 2041 for this one. And we've got a price on it here. Just to give you another one, another example fully. Okay, so now the term 2041 is 15 years from today. The coupon rate on this one is 5.85%. And redemption is on the 100. In other words, face value, what you get back is 100, is 1,000, but Excel wants everything on the 100 for bond yield calculations. So I put that in there, you don't have to worry about it. Now this one, again, you can have two payments a year or all of it in one payment. I'll just put this one at 2 just for realism. And now the price. What did I say the price was? 101,012.50. So that would be 101.25 on the 100. Now again, you won't have to do this. I'll give it to you on the 100. So you don't have to sweat that out. And before I finish this up, notice that this bond is selling at a premium to par. So the yield should be below the price. The price is, in this one, this thing is selling at a premium to par, so the yield should be below the coupon rate. Sure enough, it is. 5.72%. So the reason this price is above 1,000 is because the investors didn't need 5.85%. All they wanted was 5.72%. So when they see that coupon is better than what they want, they go in and buy a ton of these bonds, driving the price above par. One last thing I should mention here is the current yield. It's a side, kind of a side calculation. It's, you take the coupon amount and you divide that by the current price of the bond. It's like a dividend yield, where you take the dollar amount of a dividend divided by the price of the stock. It's exactly the same thing, except it applies for bonds. And I may ask you one of those. Don't confuse that when I ask you for a yield. That's the yield to maturity is much different. The current yield is just sort of a sidebar calculation, but I put it in there just so you can have it in case you get a question about it. Again, the current yield is just take the dollar value of your annual coupon and divided by the dollar value of the price. Oh, okay, so we've done that, and there's only one last thing I want to show you. And I've actually seen investors who thought they knew how to knew a lot about investments, but they went and bought bonds. They saw the quote on the ticker, they bought the bond, but they didn't expect that they were billed for more than the price that they thought they'd paid. And some of them have a fit about it because they don't know that there's something called a difference between what we call the clean price, clean, what the ticker symbol says, and the dirty price, what you actually are going to pay. Let me explain it like this. Let's say that we start at the last coupon. Let's say that the coupon rate was, 6.00%. That would mean that that is $60 per year or $30 every 6 months. Okay. So let's say last coupon, next coupon. It paid $30, and then 6 months later, 180 days later, it pays another $30. That makes it $60 for the year. What happens if you buy $60 after the last coupon? You bought here 60 days into the next coupon cycle. And then out here, you get a 30, you own it, so you get $30. But you don't own $30. Because there, the previous owner had it for 60 of those 180 days. Now I'm going to break this down to a quick, dirty little formula that you use. It works like this. Okay. You got that $30 out here, but you don't own 60 of the 180 days in it. So, the dirty premium that you have to give back to the owner before you, is 60 of those 180 days times $30. In this case, it would be $10. So whatever the price of the bond was, you have to add $10 to it, because the owner gets the price that you paid him to buy it, but the owner also gets 60 days of the next coupon. So it works simply like this. The dirty premium, which you have to add to the price of the clean price of the bond, is going to be number of days since last coupon divided by 180 times the coupon, semi-annual coupon amount. It's that simple. Don't make it complicated. Just say, okay, how long? How far into the next, this coupon cycle did I buy it? Okay. I bought it 60 days in, 50 days in, 170 days in, whatever. Divide that by the 180 of the total cycle, and that prorates, and then you figure out whatever the coupon was there. So in this case, I bought the bond 60 days into the coupon cycle out of the 180 days total in the cycle times $30, which was a 6-month coupon. And then you add that to the clean price and you get what's called the dirty price. You would be surprised at how many investors, they buy bonds and they see that the invoice was for more than they say, wait a minute, I saw the quote myself. That's right, you saw the clean quote. You didn't see the dirty quote. Well, why don't they put the dirty quote in there? Because that dirty quote changes, the dirty premium, every day that rate, that number over 180 gets bigger. So you can't really put that in there. It depends upon how many days into the coupon cycle you were when you bought it. So that's why you see only the clean price, even though you are going to pay the dirty price. Now, you know, it's not a lot. I mean, that's $10 or whatever. The worst it could be here is if you bought it on day 179, it would be almost $30 because you owned it for only one day. The original owner was the one who is owed that, you know, 179 days out of 180 times 30. So in other words, the longer you are into the coupon cycle, the 6-month coupon cycle, when you buy it, the higher that dirty premium is going to get. Were you 60 days in when you bought it? Were you 80 days in, 120 days in? So in other words, the longer you are into the current coupon cycle, the more the dirty premium is going to be on you. A little complicated, but you know, just I noticed a flaw in my formula for it, but I'll show you the formula in the second spreadsheet. But I noticed I got a little error in there that I've got to fix. But all you do in this is just put in the clean price and then the coupon rate. You're getting 2 a year. And so how long into the cycle did you buy it? But in this case, 170. Like I said, there's a little calculation error in there. But anyway, that's how you do it. And like I said, I'll fix that so that you don't even need to know what I did there. You just need to know how to put the numbers in to the spreadsheet. Okay. Enough about bonds. We now take you to one of the cores of finance, and it is risk. What distinguishes finance from other subjects like accounting and economics in general is that we are focused on risk. Risk, we turn it into a cost. It is one of those things that is a cost of a business that people don't really think about unless they take a finance view of their projects. Risk, there are a lot of different descriptions of risk. You can use risk as sort of one way to describe this phenomenon. Another one is volatility. In numbers terms, standard deviation is a measure, very popular measure of risk. In finance, beta is the very popular measure of risk. There are other ones too, like Sharpe ratio. I think they bring that one up in the book. But we need to quantify risk so that we can figure out what it does to the value of a project or what it does to the value of a cash flow. Well, this company is going to make $20 billion in 10 years. Really? Well, what risk is associated with that? What is the probability that they are going to do that? Well, about 10%. So you're no longer talking about $30 billion. You're talking about needing to adjust that amount of money for how much risk. If there's a very small probability that that's going to happen, why would you even talk about $20 billion? Because most likely that's not going to happen. Now, one thing I talk about with risk is has a couple of dimensions to it. One is risk has the dimension of how many different outcomes there are. If there's only one outcome, there's no risk. If that $20 billion is certain without any exception, it's not going to be 18, it's not going to be 25, it's not going to be 12, it's going to be that one outcome, then there's no risk. So, in other words, risk occurs with more outcomes. Now, another dimension of risk. I take you, sir, and I use my right hand, and I whack you across the side of your head to whop. Or I could take this hand and whack you across the side of your head to whap. There is very little difference between to whop and to whap, as there is with to be or not to be. But that's the question. Don't start. Okay, here we go. You see, if the outcomes are very close to each other, that's important. There's not much risk, but if the outcomes are widespread, then there is a lot of risk. Another thing is frequency versus severity. This is something that's very important in risk management and insurance, RMI. You could have something that occurs all the time, but it creates quite minimal damage. Or you could have something that occurs maybe once in 20 lifetimes, but when it happens, it is absolutely catastrophic. We have a fault line not too far from here, an actual fault line. It's called the New Madrid fault line. And the last time in recorded history of the Europeans, it happened in the early 1800s. It is that low in its probability. But when it happened, it absolutely leveled cities along its path. St. Louis was utterly destroyed. The letters that were kept from the time of this, they were for all intents and purposes like reading modern apocalyptic science fiction, how bad it was. It was so bad that it made the Mississippi River run backwards. Actually, what it did was it vaulted the waters of the Mississippi so hard that they went up stream and then they came back down like a tsunami, flooded the fields, the farmlands all around the Mississippi, laid floods all over downstate, down the stream. Okay, so it has very low frequency, but the severity is extraordinary. By the way, a couple of years ago, I was at a seminar where one of the big insurance companies was talking about calculating the risk of it and what you charge for earthquake insurance along the path of this earthquake. And the number, he showed numbers starting in the 1960s. Very, very, very low probability. So it hardly had any impact on insurance premiums. But then he showed that every year that stupid probability has been getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So in other words, it is having more impact on risk on insurance premiums because there's a higher and higher probability of it happening every year. So in other words, that probability and the severity work together, actually kind of together, to cause us to price insurance premiums, earthquake insurance premiums, a little higher every year. Let me do some number stuff here, and I want you to have your Excel sheet out. Have a clean sheet. I want to show you how Excel can make your life a lot easier when you are doing the numbers in risk. I'll even show you a really nice little formula I'll bet you don't know that makes your life a little easier. Excel works hard so we don't have to. Oh, why don't you do your attendance radar right now while we're slowing down a little bit. First things first, let me distinguish between two kinds of probability. And now, you are familiar with the term statistics. Statistics is the application of probability theory. Probability theory is a lot like work. A two-course sequence I took in grad school nearly made me decide to find something better to do with my life. But in probability theory, we have two different types of distributions. There are discrete distributions, and there are continuous distributions. Now, in discrete distributions, there is a countable number of possible outcomes. A coin toss is a discrete distribution. There's heads or there's tails, one, two. A continuous distribution is one where there are an uncountable number of possible outcomes. The normal distribution is a classic continuous. There's always a possibility of an outcome between any two given outcomes. The more possible outcomes there are in the discrete, the more in general it will behave like a continuous distribution. So in other words, if I were to weigh all of the people in this class, that would be a discrete distribution. There are not that many data points. But if I were to take the weights of all of the people in this state, that would behave very much like a continuous distribution. And so the thing, though, is the continuous distributions can get, discrete distributions are pretty easy, at least on the surface. Continuous distributions can get actually quite nasty. So we have one distribution that's continuous that we understand all about it. It's called the normal distribution. And so a lot of times you'll get, okay, this is close, this has so many data points, we'll assume it's a continuous normal distribution. That's sometimes not a good idea, and it's used too often. Like, for example, stock returns there are so many stocks, so many returns calculated from prices and all that, that we assume that it's a normal distribution. Even though it's technically a discrete distribution, we assume it's a normal. The problem is that it's not a normal. From everything that we have, all the research we've done, it is continuous. It can be modeled as continuous, but it does not converge on a normal. It converges on a really nasty continuous distribution that has the name Cauchy, C-A-U-C-H-Y. It's like a fat-tailed normal, and it's really nasty. But, okay, we have a couple of metrics that we need. One is the central tendency of the distribution. Now, the most popular is the mean, otherwise known as the weighted average. This is the most popular. And all you do, and you don't need to worry about this formula, put it in your notes because it'll make you look like you're doing a really tough course. The X bar, the mean, is from I equals the first point to the last point of the probability of each point times the value of each point. Now, you say, wait a minute, I thought you just add them up and divide by the number of points. That would be true if each point has the same weight. If there are n points, then each one would have 1 over n weight. So if you just add them up and divide by n, you are implicitly assuming that each of them has the same weight in the distribution. Another one, this is the mean. Another one is the median. This one is actually really informative. It's calculated as the place where half of the observations lie below it and half lie above it. when I look at students' test scores, I am actually more interested in the median than I am in the mean. Here's why. I could get most students score like in the 70s, 60s, and I got a tail in the one or two in the 30s and 20s and 10s. But I also have maybe five students who ace the exam. The mean, the average, is going to be affected heavily by those very high scores. They are going to skew the distribution, make it look like, oh, the average was a 78. By golly, that was good. But that's only because there were these super high scores that pulled the distribution upward. But the median, it doesn't care the size of the score. All it cares about is it in the lower 50% or the upper 50%. So it completely ignores how big or how tiny the score is. And that tell if there that's one of the things is that oftentimes I'll see the mean and the median are different. And that would tell me something very important about what really happened with the test. Using them together tells me a whole lot more than just looking at the average on the test. Okay, that's the median. Now there's another one called the mode. The mode is the most frequently occurring data value. Sometimes you'll have two that occur the same. Like I'll have a mode at 68% and I'll have a mode at 82%. Those we call bimodal. Okay, that's central tendency. And then there is dispersion. Otherwise known as risk. Now, the most popular one is the standard deviation. If you have to do it by hand, which I used to do in class, it's designated by the Greek letter sigma. It's the sum from the first data point to the last data point of the probability of each data point times the data point minus the average of the data points squared. And you take the square root of that whole mess. It's a pain in the butt to calculate by hand. Fortunately, Excel works hard, so we don't have to. I put up here on the board a distribution. This is the activity of the economy, the probability of that activity being realized, and what the GDP growth would be of that at that outcome. So you notice this is a discrete distribution. It's discrete. There's a countable number of outcomes. And you could put more in there if you wanted, but this one is illustrative. So what we're saying here is that the economy being very good has a probability of 0.25. In that case, we would have 4.20% GDP growth. And then we have a probability of 0.15 that the GDP will have a good economy, and it will be the growth will be 3.10%. Now, a blah economy has a 10.10% chance of occurring, and that growth rate would be 1.80%. Now, we could have a bad economy with a 0.35 probability, in which case the economy would actually contract and it would be negative 0.10%. Or it could be really bad with a probability of 0.15, in which case the economy would contract dramatically at a rate of negative 2.6%. First things first, the probabilities that exhaust the possible outcomes always have to add to one, whether it's discrete or continuous. I'm sure you've seen the bell curve of a normal distribution. That the area under that curve, down to the x-axis, is 1.00. Probability theory is the study of functions that have a measure of 1.00. That's what probability theory studies, is all functions that do that, discrete and continuous. And there are a lot of functions that do have that. But anyway, okay. So now, the first thing that we're going to do is calculate the mean. Now the mean, I should take probability times outcome plus probability times outcome. There is a function in Excel that allows you to do that in one swoop. It's called the sum product, equals sum product. And then you open the parentheses and you highlight the first column of in the pair of arrays, comma, the second column in the arrays, and then I have to turn that into a percent. 1.27%. It took this times this, plus this times this, plus this times, and it does it with one function. Now, many of you, I don't think, have seen this one. It is going to be useful here. And there is a place in the course where you will bless Excel because you will have a huge number of observations, probabilities, and outcomes. And all you have to do is type equals sum product, open parentheses, and then highlight the first column of data, comma, highlight the second column of data. It could be 1,000 points, whatever. And then it'll find the mean, the weighted average. Now, the next one is going to be a little bit more of a pain in the backside for us, because we will want to take each of the data points minus the average and square it. Okay? So what I'll do is I'm going to say equals the probability times, open parentheses, the data value, the GDP, minus the average down here. But I will want to make that an absolute reference by hitting F4 so that when I drag it down, that it stays on that number in the mean, and then close it. And then I will raise it to the second power. That will take care of that first nasty little piece there, that x sub I minus x bar squared for each one of them. And then I will just copy that formula down for all of them. And I will be putting this up in your classroom spreadsheets, so that if you're not keeping up, you're fine. Okay, now, standard deviation equals SQRT, I have to take the square root, of each of these I was going to do it by hand. Okay, equals square root SQRT of sum product open parentheses probability column, comma, that difference of squares, column, close the parentheses, close the parentheses, and there's your standard deviation. Now I'll turn that into a percentage. And there's the standard deviation. Now I will be putting this up, as I said. Look at the formula and kind of understand how the moving parts work together. And it's not too difficult to do this. However, there's one last thing I want to show you. It's called the coefficient of variation. You probably saw it somewhere. The standard deviation is dependent upon the size of the data points. So if I were to compare the standard deviation of prices of a small stock, goes between $7 a share and maybe $13 a share, and I looked at the standard deviation of a stock that was had a very large value, goes between $90 and $150. I couldn't compare those because they are at different scales. The small one would have a small stock would have a small cap stock would have a small standard deviation. The large cap stock would have a big standard deviation just because the numbers were smaller or bigger. So the coefficient of variation fixes that. All you do is you take the standard deviation divided by the average. And that scales the whole mess. And I want to put that to two decimal places. It doesn't have units. One of the nice things is it doesn't have units. The coefficient of variation is 0.86. And that means I could compare that number for a small cap stock, to the number for a large cap stock. They would be in the same units because there are no units. The percentages cancel, so it's a pure number. This is very useful for comparing data when you're doing comparisons of data sets where the numbers are very different in the two data sets. Like, for example, in weight, you could get the standard deviation of weights of males, standard deviation of weights of females. You can't really compare those, but their CVs, their coefficients of variation, that would tell you whether or not one distribution was wider than the other one. So that's a really nice part of this, is being able to calculate these with Excel instead of killing yourself trying to do these by hand. And as I said, I used to do them by hand myself on the board until I got sick of making mistakes, leaving parentheses out and all that. So this is the heart of the arithmetic. By the way, I was talking about standard deviation, dispersion. Standard deviation is always the one of the measure of spread in most science, in most social sciences. However, in ours, we have another, and I've told you this before. We don't use standard deviation. We use risk measure called beta. Now, there's another one even called the Sharpe ratio, which the book talks about. I avoid it with like the plague. But so there are different measures of dispersion. There are different measures of risk. And in general, you will see courses where they use sigma, standard deviation. In finance, it's almost always beta. And it actually is a ratio of standard deviation. That's enough for today. That's all I have for you.